Data, via mobile.
Gerald TR, you just going out and get some grub?
That's in Seville, headed home. What you doing?
Well, I just worked in Vietnam, the first time in my life. Never had gotten that one. On CW earlier, I was talking to Dave a little bit after that, CBA. Oh, I was just getting ready to shut this radio down, go up, hit the rain locker. And I just wanted to tell you, this is the very first time, you know, you said KFC is the only place at 1,000%. And Bernice and I went there, and I'm telling you, Dave, it was the worst I ever had in my life. It was overcooked. Now, the slaw and the mashed potatoes and gravy was fine. But we just got up and left the food on the table. It was that bad. Kicked me off so much, I sent one of those, you know, where you look at your receipt and tell them what you think. And I told them they could contact me, and I don't usually do that.
Congratulations on the Vietnam. I think I did get Vietnam one time. I don't remember for sure. I'd have to go back and look my logbook. But congratulations on that. I know that's hard to get. That's one of those rare stations to get. And sorry about your experience at KFC. What did you order? Just so that I make sure I don't order that.
Dave, I can't say that about him. Every time we've ever been there, and Bernice, you'll say so too, right? It's been excellent. But it was a new crew in there today, and she made the comment to me. She says it might be that this chicken's smaller, and everything's done on time automatically there, you know, and it cooked it worse. I didn't want to go up and start an argument or complain. I'd rather just walk away. But it's $23, and you'd think that you get a decent meal. And honest to God, those people have been wonderful, and the food's been great. This was a number 8 extra crispy, and you get 2 thighs and a leg, and then mashed potatoes and gravy and coleslaw. But I can't really say that, you know, it's ever happened before, has it, Bernice? And usually it's moist in that, and it was just dry as could be.
Unusual for them. That must have been something different like that, something new. I was there Sunday, and Amy gets a chicken pot pie every time, and I get the 2-piece breast and wing original, and mashed potatoes and gravy and green beans, and it was finger licking good. Sorry about that, Tom.
I agree with you. Yeah, and I, you know, I might not tell you what you like, but I'm always honest, Dave. And they've always been excellent. And it just really disappointed us. And so we just did without, come home and had a piece of Bernice's cranberry bread and a cup of coffee and a few white grapes. It's probably better for you anyways. What? Bernice is right. When I've been sarcastic on email, I always say R-E-I-G-H-T, right. But no, this, I don't know if it'd be any better for you, but it was finger-licking good.
Good for you. We need proteins for our brains, right? Brains need protein. That's why we're carnivores. That's what got us to where we are today. Anyway, you're going to be down in the shack for a little while, or are you headed upstairs?
Oh, I was getting ready to go up. I heard you. I was talking to a real nice guy a while ago. I didn't record his call, so I'm a KQ4. He's an EMT, and he had prior law enforcement. Oh, we got off on a subject that some people don't care for, you know, guns. But he had a lot of experience with it, and it was fun, and we talked about a lot of things, everything from parenting on down. But yeah, I was very pleased to get that one, and Dave, I'd never heard him up in Kansas, to my knowledge, and you know, I just got wire antennas here. I don't have a tower and a beam and all, but it sounded like a beehive, and I worked him right after he popped up. I was sitting there upstairs, and I thought, well, I'll go look at QRZN. And he popped up on QRZN. I thought, yeah, right, I've seen that before, but you don't hear him necessarily. And I come downstairs, and there he was, about a 5'5". there were so many CW stations trying to get him. And I'd always wanted that one because many years ago I was there, and I'm glad that's over with and done. But it was just unusual to hear him, and I got him on about the third try. And yes, I did use some power, but I wanted him back because I never had him. And he was on Logbook of the World, so that really was a good thing, you know.
Get him on. And was he in Split?
No, that was the terrible thing. He was not using Split. I was trying to tell KB4CBA how that worked, and he's got a faint knowledge of it, but not much. He hasn't been into that much. He runs FT8. But it's so much better when they do. It's still difficult because if the spread's, say, 10 kcs, you got to find him and get him right after somebody else gives him a 599 or whatever they're doing. But he was running Simplex, and that made it really difficult. And so I felt lucky. I think it's mainly because I saw it, and I come down about 3 minutes after I saw it.
A lot harder. It makes it harder to differentiate who's who. But glad you got him. one more in the logbook. How many you got down? How many countries are you down to that you haven't got? Like North Korea, for example.
Oh, that's cold, Dave. I don't know. There's only, I think 300 and some's got P5. There's very few. I don't know anybody's got P5. Maybe K4SV with all that power and tower and all of that stuff he's got up there. I've got 307. You'd have to ask somebody like N4IQ. I never really paid much attention until I come down here and the guys got me interested in it. It's the numbers, you know. And he was on 20 meters, Bernie said, you asked me the band. And that's probably one of the best bands for the DX. And then I don't use a great deal, but if I see somebody there, I do. And we're near the gray line, you know, this time of night, and so that helps the propagation and the gain. And one less skip, you know, from Kansas with respect to South Carolina. And by the sound of him, Dave, I'd say it was long pass because it had an echoic sound to it.
Atmospheric flutter going over the pole. Yeah, well, that's pretty cool. 20 meters. Gray line helps a lot. That's where I made most of my contacts. And a lot of them were gray line in the morning instead of gray line at night. But because at night I was always busy doing something else. Gray line in the morning, I could get up early enough to do that before I went to work. Not a whole lot, just a little bit to catch the gray line and then get in the car and go to work.
This is N0TR, W4DJW. Yes, sir. You got that. Bill N4IQ advised me that there was a gray line in the morning because he's an early bird, and I advised him that I was a night owl. that gray line does not exist.
Yeah, I would like it at either end of it, and sometimes I had freedom at nighttime to do that, but most of the time my nights weren't free like that. A lot of time I worked right through the gray line while I was still at work. Didn't even leave work till it was all over with, and then had an hour and a half drive to get home.
Well, and the other thing is, when I went back and looked, I never had an amplifier. I've worked them all on 100 watts or less. Most of the time 100 watts on my old Kenwood 140. And guys, CW strong, gets through real well, and they had well over 250 countries, but this will make 307. I think there's 334, but you'd have to talk to somebody that really knows, like Ariel or Bill. Ariel knows. He knows every rule in the book. He can probably recite the Constitution word for word if you ask him. That man's brilliant, kind of like you are in that respect, but when it comes to ham radio, man, don't tell him that. I used to tell him, you say something, well, that's not the rule, old Tom. And I say, well, it's Rouse's rule. And you can see the hair on the back of your neck stand up.
Whiskey Uniform 2 Tango Mobile.
Before DJW Mobile, Q-Bill, he was, he taught radio, something to do with radio at Greenville Tech, so there's no better way to get to know it inside and out than to teach it, right? He become, and I think Ariel did some of that teaching as well. I think he's still doing teaching now in his retirement. Go ahead, pick it up, Rusty, and hand it over to Tom, W4DJW Mobile.
Both of you again. I think I've talked to both of you today at least once or twice. And all. Headed to choir rehearsal. And I got out, got into the car and got ready to pull out and then realized I'd left something in the house I needed to take with me. So I had to run back in and get it. So anyway, you know, well, did you get your antennas, get the antennas all sorted out, Dave? You can tell me that when it's your turn again. Go ahead, Tom.
Good afternoon or good evening, Rusty. And I was just telling Dave I worked Vietnam on CW. I knew that you were probably busy with choir. I don't know if you could have got him. He was pretty light, but strong as I ever heard. But Dave, Bill N4IQ taught radiology at Greenville Tech. And yes, he is a brilliant man in many, many respects. He's got one of the finest ham radio stations I've ever seen in my life. It's all wires. It's not towers and all of that, but oh, the workmanship and that is just really, really great. Yeah. I'm kind of particular because I used to wire panel boxes and that, and I noticed things like that real well, and he's just a 10. And Ariel, he's teaching physics now, but he was one of the lead engineers on the turbines down at General Electric, and I think in the metallurgy, Dave, which is really exotic and very highly classified.
So that's a fun thing to get into. I did a little bit of that before I switched majors. And Rusty, that was the planning phase. So we got the planning phase of the antennas done. There wasn't any hanging or anything like that. But we know what the plan is now. Now the next phase will be the execution phase. So we'll knock out those end-to-end double bazookas in a long wire, I think. That's what we're planning on anyway. And Tom, I used to teach programming at when I was at Michelin. I used to go up to Akron and teach the guys that build tires for the competitors in CNC programming. And there's just nothing like teaching, because people ask questions, you have to go dig up the answers if you don't already know them. So you learn all the nooks and crannies really, really fast when you're teaching somebody something. Pick it up, Rusty, W4DJW.
Everything works out. I did that in the military, and I was a certified naval instructor and taught a number of classes over the different years as I was going through things. And also after I got out into the civilian world, I taught classes too. So, not at the school level, but at level for military and other people and insurance people and things like that too. So, learn a lot when you teach. You learn a lot, you teach a lot, and you learn a lot more. And as you said, Dave, that's the way you do it. You do the teaching and you learn it. And so you can tell the other people the right things. And over the years, I guess I've done a lot of teaching and learning and everything else, and I've probably forgotten as much as I learned as I still know. So it happens as you get older. Things go away if you don't work with them anymore. It's like a lot of the programming stuff I did. Don't work with it anymore, so it's kind of lost. Go ahead, Tom.
Roger, this is N0TR. Oh, I got my tuner going here. I was wanting to see some Japanese folks working that Vietnam station, but no American ones now. But I'm not hearing him on 12 meters. I didn't really expect to. It's a little too late. Showed him at 24, 898. Yeah, Dave, bless you. That the being an instructor is a rough job. The things I noticed the most, like when I was going to A school in Jacksonville and a lot of the other schools that I went to over time, in the military and civilian, there's always one guy in the class that just knows he's smarter than the instructor. Did you ever run into that?
What I was doing, the people that I was teaching were getting paid enough to where they did not do that. When they came out of that class, they needed to know how to do what I was teaching them to do. So they were very respectful, and they were like sponges, very thirsty for knowledge. So they would ask questions they wouldn't try to teach. But I have been in settings where I know what you're talking about. There are some people like that. But I was fortunate enough that these people had to have what they were getting, and when I gave it to them, the same way in France, when I was over there, I built them a compiler in their language for them, and they were getting paid really, really good, and they had to do their job really, really good, and so they weren't being wise guys like what you're talking about, but I know what you mean. But the positions, the two major teaching sessions that I have didn't have that problem.
Out here because I'm at the church and I got to go on inside, get my books and everything, get into the sanctuary for rehearsal. Talk to both of you later. N0TR to take it, W2T73.
73's Rusty. Have a nice time. Well, Dave, I went to a school for 2 weeks at General Electric in Staunton, Virginia on the 1050 HLB General Electric CNC drive. Well, when I got there, I thought they was going to give us, you know, there'd be a bunch of maintenance men, and there was, but there was also many more engineers. And I sat there for probably 10 days out of the 14, and finally I spoke up. And I said, hey, wait a minute, the stuff you're teaching is stuff for you to go in and use I think it was a PCI board, which I had. And I could actually set that board in there and go in there and modify the program, such as if I wanted the turret to have a delay in it or something like this, sort of like the computers nowadays, they handle the stoplights and all. What am I trying to say? I lost it there. But I didn't need that. And it was above my head. And so he finally got the message and come down. So I actually got about 3 days of really things, troubleshooting, you know, resolvers, tachometers, feedbacks, and spindle drives, and things of that. Well, in fact, I went to Pennsylvania to another school on the spindle drive. That was a GE value troll. But at any rate, we finally did get something out of it. I really felt lost there for a while. It was stuff like you're aware of, you know. And it would be suicide for me to go in there and change the program in that lathe for liability purposes, you know. And they'd say, well, we didn't do that. But at any rate, I'll never forget that as long as I live.
And see you later, Rusty, if you're still there. That's a big part of it, too. I just think after a while you get accustomed to that, but the price you pay for a mistake can be a human life. So they take that stuff very seriously. Those lathes will turn, over there in France, those lathes that turn mold parts, they'll turn parts that weigh as much as your house, and they're almost as big as your house. And you plunge a tool into that while it's spinning 70 miles an hour, well, you know, you don't even want to imagine what would happen if that part came off that table. And they have. People have made those mistakes before. But you don't make a mistake like that but once, and that's the end of your career.
Yeah, we had a guy, I still can see his face, and I put a new Mitsubishi drive onto a 100-inch boring mill. Let me see. No, a 16-foot boring mill, and it had a 100,000-pound bearing for a kiln on there, not sideways, and sitting on the table of that 16-foot boring mill. And, you know, the outside radius of that's moving along pretty good. And he was sitting there, or they were standing, and he was talking ironically to my boss, which he was a mechanic, and he didn't know an ohm from an amp. Wonderful guy. I got nothing against him. It just, he was a supervisor. And anyways, I seen Ross reach up there and push the button, and he pushed the rapid travel button, and you can imagine how big around that tool holder was. They were gargantuan. I mean, the thing that held the carbide tools was about 2 by 2 inches. And he hit the rapid travel button instead of the feed button, and he fed right into it. Well, we had an old Moog computer on there. And it was full of these big, huge circuit boards, Dave, and it set up the operator could actually get up on the side of the machine and walk down it and look down on the tooling and that, and ride up there, and that's where the computer was at. Well, a lot of the ICs were, they were proprietary, put it that way. I think I might even have a few of them left. And most of them were 7400s, I think. Yeah, 7400 TTLs. And they would get loose in those sockets instead of being soldering in places. Well, I tried to explain to my boss, I said, there's a thing called lag error. And I said, with the old machine, and it had happened before up in Connecticut before they moved the machine down, it would run away. And the operators up there were actually scared to run it at times because it could run a tool into a part like you're talking about. This part was 100,000-pound bearing, and it machined down to 80,000, so there's a few chips there. And I said, Gary, that can't happen. I said, he didn't hit the feed button. The machine didn't run away. I said, if that lag error kicks in, whatever it's set at, and at that point I did not know, it was brand new. I said, it's just a few thousands of an inch, and it will stop immediately. And he finally got that in his head, but he still swore up and down that the machine ran away, and so they didn't fire the guy, Dave. But you know what lag error is.
When you take up the backflash, that what you mean?
It's the commanded position to the actual position, so it would be the propagation delay between the computer and actually where the servo is at.
Yeah, we're going down Botany Woods. I don't know if you know where that is, but it is the low spot of my trip, so I didn't get all of that.
It's the commanded position as compared to the real position of where the servo's at. There is a propagation delay, electronically speaking, and if it runs out of whatever that lag error is set at, the machine stops. And so it was impossible for this to occur. He hit the rapid Travis button.
It wasn't a CNC program you were running. That was manual machining?
That was a CNC machine. And they have a lag error in there. Now, the old one in that Moog computer had analog to digital converters. And the feedback on those resolvers was analog. And then they converted through a bunch of op amps and that to digital. And but there was a lag error in there of, we'll say, let's just call it 4 thousandths of an inch. And if it exceeded that, it would fault the machine and stop it, because the commanded position wasn't where the servo was at, you know. And you had encoders on this new one sending back that digitally to the computer. And if that tool was out of position from where it was commanded by so many thousands, the lag error would stop the feed immediately.
I know what you're talking about now. Yeah, if the tool's not in position when it's supposed to be, before you go to the next instruction, then yeah, then there's something wrong. Something's binding somewhere, and you'll trip the machine out. Yeah, that's That's good for, I guess, I don't know what kind of controllers it is. We had Fanuc controllers, and that usually wasn't the problem with the horsepower that we had to drive the tool, because we had to have really high horsepower to drive the tool into the part. And that's where you get into trouble, right? And you don't have lag, and you have really high horsepower driving the machine tool.
High horsepower, it was probably 14, 16 inches in diameter, and I don't know, 2.5 feet long. There were huge rare earth samarium cobalt magnets in them, and that new Mitsubishi drive was state of the art. But if the program seen that it was out of position, and like I said, there is a slight propagation delay, you know. I mean, the electricity's going, what, 186,000 miles a second, theoretically. But if there's an error from what that encoder says that tool's at, that's attached physically to the servo, and where the command is at from the computer, it faults. And so there was no way. He ran that tool in headlong into that 100,000-pound bearing and made a huge gouge in it before he could reach up and hit the stop feed button, and should have been fired, but I didn't say anything. My boss was standing there right by it and tried to tell him the machine run away, and then engineering come in from Tulsa, and he says, no. And he says, Tom's right. And he says, that's impossible.
So that's the impossible part. What we did was we always cut everything in wax first. So we put the wax casting up there. And sometimes it had a metal back rub. But the part where the tool meets the part, was that casting was always wax on the very first time you ever ran a brand new CNC part. Right? And then they were all parametric, so you could scale them to different sizes. You didn't have to run wax on just a different scale, but you had to run wax on the very first of a first time a new CNC program was ever executed. And if it ever did, that proved the program out. Once the program was proven, then nobody was ever going to argue. You know, if you went back to the wax model and you measured the part and the part was good, the wax part was good without damaging anything, then the program was no longer questionable. Then it became a setup problem or something else if you scrapped the part. That's the way Michelin got around that. And it's cheap to scrap wax. You just melt it down and make another one.
Well, they didn't do that where I worked, but it would have been a good idea. I'll tell you that for sure.
Wax and we used graphite as well sometimes. Graphite was a little more expensive, but we used graphite because we used them in EDM machines. So you build the reverse of it in graphite, and then you burn it into the metal with the graphite on electrode discharge machine.
Well, up in Wichita, and they had those, Dave, and they were using them underwater. I'd never been around anything like that before, and I went out there on a Bandit drive. It was made by Alan Bradley. It was a CNC drive.
Might have been water. Might have been a dielectric too. That's called plunge EDM. There's multiple kinds. There's swing arm EDM. There's plunge EDM. There's wire EDM. There's all kinds of ways you can make parts you would never have dreamed you had been able to make with the wire EDM that has two axis movement on the top and two axis movement on the bottom. You can get six axes going there all at the same time. You can make some really wild parts with that.
My friend Mike up in Tulsa, he checked in one night with us here on when we was trying to get Ray's 100 stations, and I contacted him up in Tulsa, and he got on EchoLink. He was one of the most brilliant engineers that I ever worked with, and Mike, he installs a 32 spindle machine where they made these large kilns. I was trying to think what they were for. They had made the machine with these 32 spindles on it, or bought it, and he went over and married the drive to it. Boy, I'm telling you, that was something to watch.
Running all at the same time, or 32 spindles they could do automatic tool changes with.
That was 32 spindles running all at the same time.
Pretty high metal removal right there. That's a pretty awesome machine.
You know how big they were. I had to go over there and work on a 250-ton overhead crane one time, and then another one, a German crane. They couldn't get going. That 250-ton one, they used to, it was in the KCS, the Kansas Southern Railroad shops, and they'd use it to lift diesel engines and in the old days, steam engines. And that was where my dad worked years ago. But that old crane was 250 volts DC. Man, the old contactors and that was totally amazing and foreign to me. But the other crane, I can't remember now. It's been too many years. If I heard the word, I'd know. It was German, and they were really good. We had a bunch of those in the small load lifters, the two-ton ones, you know, out in the shop. And I had to repair those, and I'll never forget they kept blowing up. And so I tried to tell their engineers that they needed an electrical interlock in the forward and reverse contactor so they both couldn't come in at the same time. Well, they can't, and because it's electrically interlocked at the buttons, they told me. And I said, yeah, but when you got a welder that takes that crane and they're mounted on an I-beam, and those welders could break an anvil with a rubber hammer, they would run that crane out with a load on it and slap it up against the stop, which was angle irons, and both of those contactors would go in together, and it was 480 volts DC, and so you're cross-facing, and they would explode, and these were little relays in that little load lifter.
Controller to do a ramp up and a ramp down before they got to the end so they couldn't slam it up against the wall.
Welders had figured it out, Dave. Oh, man. Yeah, that was something else. A D-Mag, that was the name of it. Try convincing a German engineer that he's made a mistake. That's very hard when he barely speaks your language anyways, you know. But I put magnetic reversing starters in them, and we didn't have any more problems. Problem is, their specs over there, they run 50 cycle a lot, 460 volts, and so their enclosures, the specs on them are a lot smaller than what would be allowed in the United States, but for some reason they were never called on it, and so there was very little room in there at all. It was just a wiring nightmare, and I fixed them, so that took care of that. They had them down there where they had the sub-arc welder. I don't know if you ever saw sub-arc, but it was a 1,500-amp sub-arc welder that the operator rode on it, Dave. It had a kingpin and then a horizontal axis, and there was a chair out on the end of it. And they put these two 12-foot kilns together, and they had them well prepped already, which they were 1.5 inches thick, and then they had it on rollers, and the operator would run that sub-arc welder out and come down, and he'd lay a bead on that, Dave, 3/4 of an inch wide, I don't know how deep, and weld those kilns together with that. That was a lot of fun to work on, too.
Engineers, those German engineers are that way for a reason. And the reason is they're really good. I don't know what their training consists of, but it must be they let them do it right, they let them do it wrong to the high side, and they let them do it wrong to the low side, so they know where the middle is. I don't know what it is. I worked with one of them. I had the utmost respect for him. He was a BMW engineer, and he did a lot of their testing. He designed their test solutions for their cars. And oftentimes he had the latest, newest car that you wouldn't see on the road for, you know, 3 or 4 years to come. But he flew airplanes with me at WCRC. And before the FAA got involved with model aviation, right, when it was still pure and good, and it wasn't, you know, what it is now, then we did all kinds of multi-rotor flying, and he did all kinds of engineering too. He even engineered one of the German transceivers that would control a helicopter, and he did a fantastic job on it. Just kind of like Ariel, just fantastic at what he did. That's the reason they have that attitude.
Well, I think Shelley, she was over there 3 years at the Hochschule für Musik, and then she was in Austria at Vienna for a year, and she said when they get, and then don't quote me on this, you'd have to ask Shelley, the daughter up in Michigan, to like the seventh grade, they choose a path, and one of them's industry, and the other one, I guess, is education or something like that. And I agree with you 1,000%. I never worked with the guy on, when I worked at the wheel plant for 4 years, 3 of those years I worked on a helium leak detector, and I had a mass spectrometer on it and all kinds of goodies. And it was just amazing what that thing could do and the engineering on it. And it was German. And the two guys that were there before me had schooling on it, and they said, yeah, that German guy was really brilliant. And they'd actually had to fly him back over there one time to work on it. But I worked on it 3 years, and it was fun. But you're right. But they learn from a young age, and they are extremely smart. And I guess that's why they make good things, Dave. And I've seen that all my life. The German engineers are some of the best. There's no doubt about that.
W4DJW, there's another one in our Foothills Flyers Club, the club that's up here where we live, not the other club where the other guy was, which is now down there where they play soccer. But he's our vice president, the German guy, and he does the models for BMW. Somebody will do a concept car, and he'll model it and build a, you know, scaled-down version of it. And he builds his airplanes the same way he builds his BMW models. And if you set it down on a tarmac and you took a picture of it and you took a picture of the real thing and you put them side by side, you would be extremely hard-pressed to tell which one was which. That's how good he is. And this is going to be my last one because I am turning down the road to the house, and I know the dogs and the cat are inside with their legs crossed and their eyeballs rolled back in their heads. I'm going to have to take them out. Quickly, when they hear the garage door coming up, they're going to be panicking. Anyway, good talking to you, Tom. You and Bernice, enjoy the rest of the evening, and I'll catch you on Gary's Net tonight, N0TR, W4DJW.
It's been a pleasure, Dave. Yeah, we sent our youngest grandson to that BMW driving school, and I went out there and watched it. And I'm glad he's got that under his belt, put it that way. I like one of those BMWs, but they're a little pricey. But you get what you pay for. See you there, Dave. Say hi to Amy. W4DJW and 0TR 73.